sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Two Jewish are four Israeli firefighters and emergency personnel, Brigadier General Shmulek Friedman, Chief of Operations for Israel Fire and Rescue, Chief of Policy Avi Borger of NEMA, the National Emergency Management Agency, Major Sivan Inbar of the Home Front Command of IDF, the Israeli Army, and Guy Caspi, Chief Instructor in Hazmat Training for Magen David Adom. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Fall has arrived here in southern Arizona, and a truly beautiful season it is. Mornings are cool, days pleasant, it feels good to be outside and alive. Autumn is the season of change, a time to thank God for the goodness of the natural world before the shorter days and colder weather of winter. It is also a good time to acknowledge a very interesting change taking place in the politics of the Middle East. 4.5 years after the explosion of the so-called Arab Spring, in the aftermath of last summer's Iran nuclear deal, a realignment in the relationships and even the alliances among nations in this challenging region is occurring. Here on Two Jewish, we've commented on recent overtures in the Saudi Arabian press towards Israel and the decided cooling of relations between most of the Arab oil states and the Palestinians. There have been semi-secret contacts between Saudi Arabia and Israel over the last year. Then last week, for the first time, a prominent member of the Saudi royal family came out with a dramatic statement about Israel. His Royal Highness Prince Al-Walid bin Talal is the grandson of the founder of Saudi Arabia, that is, the first King Saud appointed by the British, and of course he's a billionaire. I wonder how many of them Saudi Arabia has. Anyway, Prince Al-Walid is also, according to Forbes magazine, the richest Arab in the world and, according to many publications, the single most influential Arab in the world. His investment empire, through his Kingdom Holding Company, includes many top-level international brand-name companies in real estate, hotels, media, and technology. He is a major world player, and he's likely speaking for some of the Saudi Arabian leadership, maybe all of it, which speaks on behalf of most of the Gulf Arab states as well. What was notable about his statement was its comprehensiveness. Last week, Prince Al-Walid said that in the event of another Palestinian intifada against Israel, he would side with Israel, saying that Saudi Arabia has reached a political maturity to constitute a durable alliance with the Jewish nation. He added, "I will side with the Jewish state and its democratic aspirations in case of outbreak of a Palestinian intifada. I shall exert all my influence to break any ominous Arab initiatives set to condemn Tel Aviv, because I deem the Arab-Israeli entente and future friendship necessary to impede the Iranian dangerous encroachment." In other words, "I know that the Iranians seek to unseat the Saudi regime by playing the Palestinian card," he said. "Hence, to foil their plots, Saudi Arabia and Israel must bolster their relations and form a united front to stymie Tehran's agenda." Al-Walid added that Riyadh and Tel Aviv must achieve a modus vivendi, for Saudi policy in regard to the Arab-Israeli crisis is no longer tenable. Wow. While this is still a long way from any Israeli-Saudi Arabian alliance, it continues a trend that has seen the sands shifting throughout the Middle East. An anti-Iran confluence of interests has developed that includes Israel and moderate Arab states like Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia aligning against Iran and its proxies, particularly Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas. Russia's recent entry into the fray only adds impetus to this realignment. Quite a change, indeed. Play us in on this fall morning. Here's a lovely choral Lachadodi from Samuel Adler, a song of welcome for the Shabbat, the Sabbath bride.
Lachadodi
That was Samuel Adler's L'chad Odi. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our special guests, top Israeli firefighters and rescue personnel who have been touring Arizona. They are Brigadier General Shmulek Friedman, head of all Israeli firefighters, the chief of NEMA, Avi Borger, the Israeli equivalent of FEMA, Guy Caspi of Hazmat Control from Magen David Adom, the Israeli version of the Red Cross, and Major Sivan Inbar of Homefront Command. Each will explain his or her roles protecting the public in Israel and coping with emergencies and share what they've learned in America when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Mara Aspinall is a renowned expert on biotech issues. She has founded and led several medical research facilities, public, private, and nonprofit, and is a worldwide leader in the development of new medical techniques.
I am speaking today about the Pima County bond election to give you accurate information about the university tech parks, the business incubators. No one wants higher taxes, but these incubators are key investments for economic growth of our county. Business incubators work. When these companies grow, they create high-paying private sector jobs and they stay in our county. When these companies grow, they keep our recent graduates employed in our county. For every dollar invested, $30 of local tax revenue is generated. Please vote for the Pima County bonds. Invest in our county.
Paid for by Elect Ray Carroll.
We have four very special guests with us this morning here on Too Jewish. Israeli top emergency personnel who have come touring Arizona and exchanging ideas, learning from us and teaching us as well. I want to welcome first Avi Borger, the Chief of Policy for the Israel Emergency Management Authority, NEMA, which is the Israeli equivalent of FEMA, I guess, here. Tell us a little bit about your experience coming to Arizona, but also about what your agency does and what its specific responsibility is in emergency situations in Israel.
NEMA is responsible for all the civil arena in Israel. NEMA is responsible to preparedness and response plans on the national level. My job is, I'm the operation officer of NEMA, and I'm responsible specifically for these plans. NEMA was established in 2007, and it is under the Minister of Defense.
You know, those of us who spend time in Israel understand that Israeli organizational concepts are different from American organizational concepts. Can you explain a little bit about some of the challenges in pulling together all of these different organizations?
Yes, of course. The emergency structure is different between Israel and the United States. We don't have in Israel the nation, the federal level, the state level, and the local level. We have two levels, the local level and the government level.
Medinat Yisrael, the state level.
Yes, the state level. And it's different because two ministries are responsible for emergencies. In routine, the Ministry of Interior Security is responsible, but in war and big emergencies, the Ministry of Defense is responsible. So it's not like the United States when one office is responsible from the start of the event until it finishes. That's the difference.
You know, it's interesting because Israel experiences so many things that in the United States we would believe to be huge emergencies. In Israel, they don't qualify as emergencies. We'll talk some more about that when we come back with these incredible Israeli firefighters and emergency personnel when we come back in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TooJewishRadio.com, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We are coming up on a very sad anniversary on the English calendar. It was a little earlier on the Hebrew calendar. The anniversary of the 20th year since Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in what was then Kings of Israel Square. Now it's Rabin Square in Tel Aviv. This was really an earth-shaking change for Israel. Well, take us back to that time.
So I remember this very clear since I was living in Tel Aviv back then.
It's the way Americans used to talk about where they were when Kennedy was shot. It's the same kind of thing.
So I really can, I remember this time that, you know, just after the Oslo agreement, and I think it was the first time, I was around 20th. So it was the first time to see a huge gap between, you know, Am Israel. Because, you know, to put a rabbin with a kafia or as a Nazi is things that I wasn't used to at all.
About the right-wing propaganda or the propaganda against Rabin.
The propaganda that at the end, you know,
the Israeli propaganda against
Israeli
Rabin.
Propaganda, right, that created the
the right kind of hateful environment,
you know,
right.
to assassinate a Prime Minister by a Jewish right radical ones. So anyway, as I said, like I was in Tel Aviv, like same town, and it was on the TV, all the pictures from, you know, from the Atzeret, from the, how do you say Atzeret?
Well, assembly.
You know,
it was
assembly, you know, and Rabin was, you know,
was
Rabin
rally.
And
it was,
Peres.
It was a rally, really, rally. I think I would say. And the rally was in favor of the Oslo Accords,
Nahon.
Which were
was,
in a little bit of political trouble
like
in Israel.
It was like rally for peace.
Right.
And Peres was on the stage, and Rabin, and Miri Aloni, and they all sang the Shir LaShalom. And then, you know, I don't know if they even finished the song, and then he put the, you know, the words of the song in his pocket afterwards they, you know, it was all blood,
right.
You know, Shir LaShalom, how symbolic
the song
was
of peace,
song,
and it's covered
song
with
of
blood.
Peace. So, and it was really, really the next days were created even a huge gap between all of us, because it was not just, you know, it was like separate, those who believed in peace and wanted to have peace, even though they didn't agree with all the, you know, the Oslo agreement, and those who, you know, was willing to assassinate in Israel, to murder an Israel a prime minister, and actually to murder the chance to have peace, you know, in Israel, like, and it was a lot of accusing, you know, between
machanot. Accusations back and forth.
Groups,
right.
You know, if it's from the, if the Likud, if, you know, and how, and a lot of questions, how we allowed, you know, that if it's the education system, if the, you know, how.
A lot of self-criticism.
A very
how
normative
could this
young man who studied law at the University of Bar-Ilan, like, how come? What was the environment that allowed this to happen? Is it like only one crazy person, or is a trend, or that was these days, you know, they too, like almost like after the first plane of September 11,
yeah, the
you know,
9/11
the one when the first happened, and then the second, he said, okay, it's going to be third. So also here was, okay, is it going to stop now or are we going to see
someone going to shoot Peres? Is, you know, I heard those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a traumatic memory for Israel. There's a Rabin Center, which is an incredible museum and a center for peace studies. But I don't know that Israel has ever fully recovered from that experience.
I don't know if we will fully recover ever.
Thank you, Ashrat. We'll talk next
Toda
week.
Toda Rabbi.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, this refugee crisis, the greatest since the end of World War II, doesn't get any smaller. It's not going away anytime soon. Israel has some of its own refugee crises. While Israel has always been very good at accepting Jews from every country in the world and has by and large integrated them in pretty impressive ways, have problems with immigrants coming from Africa who are seeking asylum and seeking some economic opportunity, and they haven't always handled them well. There's detention centers in the South that have produced a great deal of protest. Problematic situation in Israel, but in an interesting way reflective of this larger refugee crisis everywhere.
Right. Well, there are some similarities and some differences. I mean, first of all, Israel has not been a refuge for people fleeing the Syrian civil war for a bunch of obvious reasons.
Yeah, fairly obvious reasons.
It's a pretty heavily fortified border, and people in Syria have been conditioned to see Israel as the enemy. Israel does have an increasingly diverse population of so-called legal, well-documented aliens who really are alien in terms of looks and culture and religion, people from Thailand and the Philippines who mostly are caretakers and people who work with the elderly and healthcare workers, whatever.
Things like that, right?
And there's a huge number of them. I mean, if you go to the Tel Aviv Central bus station these days, you feel like you could be in Bangkok or Manila almost. I mean, it's quite different from the Israel of 30 or 40 years ago. But those people don't end up in detention centers. The ones who do are even more visibly different, and they tend to be Black Christians from sub-Saharan Africa, Ethiopian, Somalian, Sudanese, who often arrive in Israel by foot, who are poor and desperate, who are persecuted. And, you know, we in our tradition have a bunch of prescriptions and proscriptions about treating strangers because we were strangers in the land of Egypt, and we're enjoined to be kind and generous to strangers. And Israel, I think, sometimes has a tough time balancing those traditional values with the political reality of what do we do with these people, especially if they have no skills, no language. Do we spend money to teach them Hebrew and try to absorb them? They're not Jewish. We dilute the character of the Jewish state. Why didn't they stay in Egypt? Well, because Egypt's not really very good with Christians, and it's driven out most of its own historic Christian population, the Coptic Egyptians. So there's a lot going on there. But another important difference is that some European countries, at least, like Italy, France, and England, have a history of colonial empires, and they feel a certain degree of either guilt or responsibility or whatever to refugees from their former colonies. So you have lots of Pakistanis and Ghanaians and Nigerians and Indians living in all over England, not only in London, but all over, even in the smallest towns. In France, you have lots of Tunisians, Moroccans, Algerians from former French colonies. In Italy, you have lots of Ethiopians, Somalis, and Libyans
from former Italian colonies.
Right. And that's sort of understandable. Israel obviously never had a colonial empire.
right.
You know, to the extent that it did, it was the Jewish diaspora, and those people are taken in and well taken care of. So, you know, it's both the same and different.
Yeah, interesting. The notion that we are supposed to understand the plight of the refugee is central to the Jewish character, but it comes into conflict when you're not really sure what to do about a circumstance as exists right now.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none.
From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Tour to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going from May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you're interested in going on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing the Holy Land from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi, a priest, and a minister have houses of worship side by side. Each congregation gets their clergyman a new car, a Buick for the minister, a Cadillac for the priest, and a Lincoln for the rabbi. But gas prices being what they are, they decide to share the wealth in carpool. On the first day, the other two are shocked to see the pastor lay his hands on the roof of the Buick and pray. "What are you doing?" the priest asks. The pastor looks up. "I'm just dedicating this car to the Lord's service." "Good idea. Be right back," the priest says, runs into his church, comes out with a scepter on a short stick, shakes water out of it onto the Cadillac. The rabbi stares. "What are you doing?" he says. "I'm consecrating the car with holy water," the priest replies. "Great idea," the rabbi says, runs into the synagogue's tool shed, comes out with a hacksaw, and cuts 2 inches off the tailpipe of the Lincoln. You know, it's not that you can really circumcise a car. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Negotiation gets a bad rap these days. Many people see the give and take necessary to reach consensus as a kind of moral compromise, a sacrifice of ideals on the false idol altar of base pragmatism. Compromise? Consensus? Agreement? Not words we hear much in an election year. But real progress in this world is usually the result of masao matan, the horse trading and log rolling that allows society to solve its problems and attain new and important accomplishments. Where difference of opinion exists, and it always does, reasonable negotiation eventually leads to productive resolution. The Torah teaches that lesson in this week's portion of Chaye Sarah. Chaye Sarah marks a transition in the Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, to the next generation, which features Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we start with an ending. At the beginning of the portion, we are told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident, we learn she has died. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the Seder begins, and the famous Midrash on it tells us that Sarah was just as beautiful at age 100 as she was at 20, and just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. It's a fine encomium for a significant figure who passes permanently from the scene. Next come the negotiations, which have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion, someday to be known as Judaism. An extended section dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral as Abraham arranges the purchase of the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will be known as the Land of Israel, follows. That cave becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah all find their final resting place in Machpelah in Hebron. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an elaborate bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I first visited Machpelah many years ago when it was safe to travel to Hebron. It's an interesting shrine, at that time filled with candles and smoke, ancient, a bit spooky. When I went back in February of this year, I was only able to access the second floor, the Jewish section, as the caves below are now reserved for Muslim prayer, and the Israeli army enforces the rule. With the recent attacks going on and this latest wave of Palestinian-Arab violence, it's probably not worth the danger to life and limb for a trip to Palestinian Hebron, locus of Arab violence against Jews. After the Cave of Machpelah negotiation, Chaye Sara includes one last detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham's old, sees that his son Isaac has not married and is unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country, Sumeria, Haran, today in eastern Turkey, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and so carry on the line of believers in the one true God. The servant goes on the great journey from Canaan. He arrives and offers the first extended prayer in the Torah, asking the God of Abraham for success. Immediately, Rebekah appears to draw water from the city well in Haran. He knows she's the one for Isaac because she shows instinctive generosity and obvious intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case with Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, they arrange for her to become Isaac's wife, but at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebekah's family puts the question directly to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she's known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation of Chaye Sara is brief. Rebekah agrees quickly to go. Yes, she will leave her homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. And so she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebekah and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals today. Often they still require negotiation to achieve. A secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. Aren't those causes worth negotiating for? When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our special guests, top Israeli firefighters and rescue personnel, Brigadier General Shmulek Friedman, Avi Borger, Guy Kaspi, and Major Sivan Inbar, will explain their roles in protecting the public in Israel and coping with emergencies, and share what they've learned here in America and what they might be able to teach us about emergency services. Don't miss it when we come back here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A daughter-in-law of Adolf Eichmann, the late Nazi war criminal who masterminded the near annihilation of Hungarian Jewry, withdrew her mayoral candidacy in Argentina after defending Eichmann's actions on TV. Carmen Breton Lindemann announced last week she was bowing out of the mayoral race in the northeastern village of Garupa after receiving intense criticism for what she said about Eichmann during a TV interview. "The history that you know is not the real one. The version that you know from movies and books is written by the Jews, and all the world accepts that history," she said. "He wasn't a bad person. He obeyed orders and did not personally kill anyone," she added, calling Eichmann grandpa. Breton Lindemann ran as a representative of a new alternative, an Argentinian political party led by presidential candidate Sergio Massa. After the interview was aired, she was expelled from the party. In a statement following the expulsion, she wrote, "In order not to hurt my fellow party members in the alliance, my immediate resignation is necessary." Actually, she had already been expelled. "I want to assure the public that I don't and never did support the Nazis." The Argentine Jewish political umbrella, DAIA, condemned Breton Lindemann for denying the extermination during the Shoah and the vindication of Nazism. The trial of Eichmann, who was executed in Israel in 1962 following conviction for crimes against humanity, led Hannah Arendt to write about what she termed the banality of evil. She argued that Eichmann was an example of how normal individuals will, given the right circumstances, carry out atrocities without recognizing them as such. But Gabriel Bach, a retired justice of the Israeli Supreme Court who was the prosecutor in Eichmann's trial, disputed that, describing Eichmann as an ideologically motivated murderer of Jews who went to extreme lengths to kill as many Jews as possible. In other news, in Israel, a 10-year-old Russian boy, Matvey Chepelyav, made an extraordinary discovery in Jerusalem. Working as a volunteer in the large Temple Mount sifting project, he found a 3,000-year-old seal, an engraved piece of limestone about the size of a thimble with a hole at one end so it could be hung from a string, that dated to the time of King David. The artifact was nestled in the hundreds of tons of earth and rock that were illegally excavated from below the Temple Mount in the late 1990s by the Muslim Waqif, the corrupt Islamic trust that retains authority over the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is sacred ground for Jews and also for Muslims and Christians. Jewish historical claims are now being denied falsely by Palestinians. The sifting project in Emek Tzurim National Park in Jerusalem started in 2005. It has uncovered several historically significant objects, but this seal may be the most important. Dating from King David's conquest of Jerusalem and the building of the first temple by his son and successor Solomon, the seal confirms the ancient Jewish presence in Jerusalem, more than 1,500 years, a millennium and a half before the Muslim Dome of the Rock was built above the ruins of the ancient Jewish temples. It is ironic that illegal Muslim excavation undertaken to build an underground mosque confirmed Jews' historical claims. It is just as ironic as the fact that the Waqif came to rule the site at Israel's initiative. Following Israel's miraculous victory over Arab invaders in the Six-Day War in June of 67, which included capturing the old city of Jerusalem, Israeli General Mota Gur proclaimed Har Habayit Biyadenu, the Temple Mount is in our hands. Israeli soldiers gathered joyously at the Kotel, the western wall below, and sang Hatikva. Shlomo Goren, a brigadier general and future chief rabbi of Israel, exultantly blew his shofar. Defense Minister Moshe Dayan had other ideas about Jewish sovereignty on the Temple Mount, though. A secular Israeli, he relied on a rabbinical consensus that Jews were forbidden to set foot on the Mount, lest they risk accidentally stepping on the site of the Holy of Holies, desecrating the inner sanctuary of the Jewish temple that had once housed the Ark of the Covenant. Moshe Dayan was concerned about the long-term effect on public opinion in the Muslim world, believing that asserting Israeli control and Jewish worship on the Temple Mount would lead to international jihad against Israel. After declaring, "We have reunited the city, the capital of Israel, never to part it again," Dayan met with Muslim leaders inside the Dome of the Rock, and an agreement was reached. The Waqif ban on Jews visiting the Temple Mount ended, but Jews wouldn't be allowed to pray while they were there. For years, the Waqif has continued to oversee excavations below the surface of the Temple Mount with total disregard for what archaeologists could learn about the true history of the Mount in antiquity. It remains a deliberate effort to destroy the history of the Temple Mount and, of course, the central Jewish place in it. That policy fits perfectly with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's twisted and dishonest dismissal of any Jewish connection to the Temple Mount. "Al-Aqsa is ours and so is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They have no right to desecrate them with their filthy feet," Abbas told Palestinian activists at an October 14th meeting in his Ramallah office. Not that we Jews ever doubted our religious roots on the Temple Mount, but we now have a 10-year-old boy to thank for providing a 3,000-year-old artifact that refutes modern Palestinian propaganda designed to rewrite history. Just as the seal was used in King David's time as evidence of authority, today it puts a stamp of approval on Jewish claims to our real history at the holiest site in Jerusalem. And it demonstrates again the flat-out lies being told by Palestinians about the holiest place in the world for Jews. While this was going on, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's brother-in-law underwent life-saving heart surgery at a private hospital in Tel Aviv last week. He was hospitalized at the Asuda Medical Center in northern Tel Aviv. The surgery worked. He's in intensive care. Despite recent attacks on Israelis by Palestinians, Israel approved the entry of Abbas's wife's brother to receive treatment. Only Israelis would do this. Remarkable. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish. Our very special guest this morning, Israeli firefighters, but that's not really correct. Emergency coordination personnel, Avi Berger, whom we heard earlier in the show, the chief of policy for NEMA, the Israeli Emergency Management Authority, Brigadier General Shmulek Friedman, the chief of operations of Israel Fire and Rescue, Guy Kaspi, the chief MCI instructor, the director of HAZMAT, and Major Sivan Inbar, the head of population training program for the National Urban Search and Rescue and Civil Defense School, Homefront Command of the IDF. You have the longest title, Sivan. I think that perhaps, and maybe ladies go first in America, will be sexist. Tell us a little bit about your responsibilities in emergency situations, and also what constitutes an emergency situation from an Israeli perspective and from the IDF's perspective.
Okay, so my job, as you said, the head of population training program. So we mostly work with civilians. We prepare them for any kind of emergency. We're teaching them how to react for the first minutes when they're having an earthquake or war scenario and any kind of this. So what we do right now is several things. For the last 20 years, we go in to fifth grade classes, and we're teaching the kids what to do in any kind of emergencies. And then they go home, and they are teaching their parents how to be prepared for earthquake, how to be prepared for a missile war and terror and everything. We also have, for the last couple of years, we started to teach the teachers another program, which they are teaching the kids in the other grades. So for the first grade, the third grade, and every two grades, the kids know more and more about emergency situation. So probably each year we get so many kids to know how to be prepared for any kind of emergencies, and they can pass it on to their families.
So this is a very silly question. How did you pick fifth grade as opposed to fourth grade, sixth grade? Why fifth graders?
They are old enough. They are probably 10-year-old, so they are old enough to understand how to be prepared real good for emergencies. And they also do homework with their parents.
They're not sitting alone doing their homework because their math is too hard for their parents. 10th grade, 10-year-olds, I can still do 10-year-old math. I see.
Yeah, so they're doing it together. It's important to us that those kids will pass it on, all this knowledge they get from our soldiers to their families.
You know, it's fascinating. Some of us, not so young anymore, who grew up in America, remember the atomic bomb drills that we used to have in grade school, where we would go hide under the desk and they'd tell us what to do in a nuclear attack at the height of the Cold War. That faded, but I still remember what to do. So maybe that's the right age to teach, to make sure.
It works.
It works.
It works.
It's unfortunate that it's necessary, but it does work. I'm going to ask Shmulek Friedman, the Brigadier General, Chief of Operations of Israel Fire and Rescue, to tell us a little bit about what role Fire and Rescue plays and how it integrates with the other aspects of emergency preparedness.
Okay, first thing that you have to know that after the big fire in the Carmel Mountain in 2010, the Israeli government decided to make a big revolution and the big reform in the firefighting services, because everybody understand that we was in a very bad shape and we didn't have the abilities to deal with the very big events. So for the last 2 years, we are a federal authority. We change all our structure and we unite all the different departments to one authority. We organize in a new structure of 7 districts. And now we're in a very, very good process, and we're getting better and better every day. We recruit many new firefighters. We bought many new fire trucks, and we changed our procedures, and we have now a national radio system with the police, so we're getting better every day. Still, we have very huge gaps. This is was the purpose of my mission here, to see how can we get better in things that we are now still, I call it, in the diapers, like how we treat our firefighters, the health of the firefighters, how we treat some of our equipment, our training facilities, and so on. This is things that you have much, much better than us, and I learned a lot from the people here. Everyone we saw, the Jewish community, the firefighters, all the first responders, they host us in a very, very nice way. It's very, very unique. It's very emotional and exciting for us. And we learn a lot. And I think it's going to make changes in the Israeli authority and make us progress faster.
Guy Cuspy is the Chief MCI Instructor, Director of HAZMAT. Hazardous materials, interesting challenge. In America, it's a huge and complicated field. It must be complicated as well in Israel. Can you explain the major issues that you deal with?
Just to put the things in the right perspective, we as an EMS are taking just a small portion of the hazmat, because most of the hard job and the professional job is done by the firefighters. We as an EMS are responsible for taking care of the casualties on those situations. And due to lessons learned around the world, especially after the sarin attack in Tokyo in 1995, we realized as a state of Israel, we should have capabilities to take care of what we call TMCIs, toxicological multi-casualty incidents. And because of so, our crews are trained to use personal protection gear, what we call the level C, to be able to assist the firefighters to execute and to pull up casualties from the what we call the hot zone, the contaminated area, and provide them with medical care. So just to make it clear, the leaders are the firefighters in this arena.
What kinds, this is an awful subject to talk about for a regular citizen, but what kinds of chemical attacks or biological attacks does Israel anticipate?
Well, the frame of challenges is enormous, starting with accidents and, of course, terrorist attack. And I think Shmulik, as a firefighter, will be much precise than me dealing with those
about
issues.
The specifics. Okay, so let's pass the mic to Shmulik.
We have all the kinds of hazmat, I think, that you have here. It's, you know, the regular stuff of the industry and so on. In some of the ways in Israel, we also deal with pirates that make things without license. So we don't know exactly what we're dealing with. And this is a very big problem. And the other aspect is, of course, non-biological terror that can hurt us. And we dealing it together with the police, with the army, and with the home front command, and we try to make us prepare as we can, because this is something that you don't know exactly when it's happened, when it's going to happen, and what will be the material and how much. So it's very, very hard, but we have our procedures how to deal with that.
How, and this is a question for all of you, how do you balance, how do you know when it's a military responsibility as opposed to a civilian responsibility in an emergency situation? All of you have to deal with this, I'm sure.
Only the government is a sole site to declare an emergency. And it will be mainly in war or in an earthquake. But in all other situations, it's routine. At first of the responsibility between the Ministry of Public Security and the Ministry of Defense, it's quite clear who is responsible. We have an SOP, how to transfer the responsibility between the police, which is one of the organizations of the Ministry of Public Security, to the Army and the Home Front Command, which is under the responsibility of the Minister of Defense.
So I asked you all a question at Shabbat services at Temple Emmanuel, in which I said, in the current emergency in which there's stabbings and a series of attacks, people driving cars into civilians and rock attacks and what looks to those of us living in the United States as a major national emergency, and you all answered the same thing, it's not really an emergency. So that was a shocking thing, I think, for many Americans to hear, because, of course, for us, if such a series of events had taken place in Washington, D.C., or New York, or Los Angeles, or Tucson, Arizona, we would expect the FBI and the NSA and everybody to have, all the national organizations would come down and the military would get involved. Not so in Israel. Can you explain that distinction? Because I don't think Americans understand that.
Yes. The difference between Israel and the United States is that Israelis have these events all the time. The intensity in these 3 weeks is higher, but we have it all the year. So we are familiar with it. The second reason is all these events are local events. They are focused in one place, and the events take sometimes seconds. So we don't have to declare an emergency, a national emergency. It's local event, and it's finished by seconds.
So it has to do with the duration. I think it's also perspective. As you said, you're used to it. I was funny. I was looking back at a radio show to look up a guest from a year before, and I saw how everybody was speculating in 2014 in the fall of November or so that this was a time, was it the Third Intifada, and there'd been an assassination attack and on a right-wing leader, and there'd been a series of cars driven into people standing at light rail. That was 12 months ago, and everybody forgot it since then. So the difference between Israel and America could not be more explicit in that. I'm going to ask you one last question. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but first of all, we don't have more time. And second of all, you all have to go back to Israel because you have jobs. What was your favorite part of your experience in coming and the exchange that you've had with the American emergency personnel and the Jewish communities here in Arizona as well?
I guess one of the most impressive things that we saw here is the people. And I'll put beside the professionality and the equipment and the high-tech training facilities. But whoever we met with was amazing. First responders, the Jewish community, everybody.
I want to say that I think it's been a mutual experience, because everybody I've talked to, and my experience as well, has been you guys are just spectacular. You make us feel good about everything that's going on in Israel.
You are very spectacular also. This is the main thing is the people here. It's wonderful people, and I think that you should be proud of all the people. Everybody that we met, professional, nice guys, want to help us, open the doors, and we are very, very appreciate that, and come to Israel. We are also like that.
And you can come on the Temple Emmanuel trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan in May and June of 2016. I want to thank Avi Borger, Shmulek Friedman, Guy Kaspi, and Sivan Imbar for a fantastic visit here on Too Jewish. You can learn more about Israel, lots of ways. And I want to say in the Siyah Tova, a good trip back to Israel. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Ambassador Dennis Ross, renowned authority on the Middle East and author of a new book, Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Sephardic music group The Voice of the Turtle, the music of the Spanish Jews of Jerusalem. It's called Asentana en la Ventana. May you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Asentada a la ventana, cara de luz y papel, me dijiste sufriendo como peche en la sartén.